So, before we even get into the weeds today, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel.
Yeah, they're awesome.
They really are. They've got a full Series 3 course with like adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams.
And those exams are weighted just like the real thing, which is huge.
Exactly. It's everything you need. So definitely check it out at certfuel.com. But anyway, let's jump right in because I want you to imagine
Yeah,
something.
lay it on me.
Imagine walking into a normal everyday bank with, say, $10,000 in cash. You hand it to the teller, open an account, and the teller just looks you dead in the eye and goes, "Just so you know, depending on the market today, you might owe us $50,000 by tomorrow morning."
Wow. Yeah, that's intense.
Right. And if you don't have it, we will literally sue you. Like in the normal banking world, that sounds completely
Sounds
insane.
like a scam, honestly.
Totally. But in the futures market, that is just a regular Tuesday. It's legally mandated. The rules are so radically different from anything else in finance that regulators built an absolute fortress around it.
They had to. I mean, it's a completely different ecosystem.
Yeah.
And if you assume it works like retail banking or even standard stock brokering, you are going to get completely run over.
Which is exactly why we're doing this deep dive into Series 3 general registration and account rules. Because if you're taking this exam, you're trying to become a licensed pro. Our mission today is to deeply learn, retain, and apply this stuff.
So you can just walk into the testing center and absolutely crush it.
Yeah.
But we should probably establish the stakes right away.
Oh, yeah, the stakes are wild.
If you look at the exam breakdown, Chapter 8, which is regulations, is roughly 29% of your test. That's 35 out of 120 scored questions.
It's a massive chunk, but it's not even just the volume, right? The grading structure is basically ruthless.
Oh, completely unforgiving.
It's an independent pass-fail island.
Right, because the exam is in two parts. You have market knowledge and regulations, and they grade them separately.
You need a 70% on regulations alone.
Just to pass that section, yeah.
I really want that to sink in for you, the listener. Like, you could be a math genius. You could calculate synthetic hedging spreads in your sleep and get a 99 on the market knowledge part.
But if you get a 69 on regulation,
You fail. Hard stop. Your brilliant math skills cannot save you here.
yeah, you cannot understudy the rule book. But hey, silver lining for everyone listening, there is zero math in this section.
Fucking goodness.
I mean it. No calculators. It's purely conceptual. It's all about definitions, documents, and, grasping a few very deliberate distinctions.
Right. And we know studying regulations can feel like, I don't know, reading a phone book in another language.
It's dry.
Super dry. So here are our rules of engagement today. We are not just going to read a textbook at you. We're going to use absurd scenarios. We've got a whole cast of recurring characters you're going to meet, and we're really going to dig into the why behind the rules. Because if you understand why a rule exists, you don't have to just blindly memorize it.
Exactly. And we'll occasionally stop and ask you direct questions right to your face to make sure you're tracking.
Because if you just passively listen while doing the dishes, the exam will trick you. The writers are so good at making wrong answers sound right.
They really are. So let's start at the absolute beginning. Before you can even talk to a customer, you have to get past the gatekeepers.
Right, getting into the industry. And there isn't just one bouncer at this club, there are two.
Two massive regulators. They speak different languages, they care about different things. You've got the CFTC and the NFA.
CFTC and NFA.
Okay. And you have to compartmentalize them right now because the exam is going to try everything to blur them together.
Okay, so let's break them down. Who is the big boss? Regulator number one.
The big boss is the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the CFTC. They are a federal government agency.
Created by Congress, right?
Under the Commodity Exchange Act, or the CEA.
Which is basically the constitution of the futures industry.
Exactly. It's federal law. Now, the CFTC's main job for a new firm is granting the official registration. They define the legal categories, and you have to register your existence with them.
So, government agency, official federal license. Got it. What about the second one?
The National Futures Association, the NFA. And here's the crucial distinction. They are not the federal government.
Wait, they aren't?
No, they are an SRO, a self-regulatory organization.
Okay.
They grant membership, not federal registration, and their job is to write and enforce the day-to-day conduct rules for their members.
Okay, I think an analogy will lock this in perfectly. Think of the CFTC like the DMV.
That's a great way to look at it.
They give you the physical driver's license, right? federal permission to drive on the road.
Right.
But the NFA, they're like the incredibly strict bouncer at an exclusive country club.
Or a really intense professional association.
Yeah, exactly. They look at your DMV license, they let you into the club as a member, and then they walk around the clubhouse making sure you aren't spilling drinks or insulting the guests.
They enforce the daily house rules.
Yeah.
And they can kick you out if you act up.
That dynamic is so important. But why two? Why doesn't the government just do both?
Well, think about the practical reality. The federal government doesn't have the budget or the manpower to micromanage every single office's phone scripts and brochures.
Yeah, they can't have an FBI agent in every brokerage monitoring cold calls.
Exactly. It'd be a bureaucratic nightmare. So they outsource the daily policing to the industry itself, the SRO model. The NFA is funded by industry dues and staffed by people who actually understand the market mechanics.
So listener, let's apply this. Say I want to open a public-facing brokerage firm. I do the federal paperwork, I pay the massive fees, and I get my official CFTC license.
Okay, you're federally registered.
Right. But then I look at my budget and say, man, NFA dues are expensive. I'm just going to skip joining the NFA. I have the federal license anyway. Are they good to go? It's not a chance.
No.
A firm dealing with the public has to clear both gates. You try to solicit one single customer without NFA membership, you are operating illegally.
So this is a massive exam trap, isn't it?
Though it's one of their favorites, and that the people just see a blur of acronyms when they cram. So they'll deliberately swap the roles in the multiple choice options.
Right. They'll ask, who enforces day-to-day ethical conduct, and offer the CFTC as an answer.
And that's a trap. NFA wants the daily rules, or they'll ask who grants federal registration and offer the NFA. Wrong again.
CFTC registers. NFA polices daily behavior. Boom. Baseline established.
So once you know who the bouncers are, you need to know who is standing in line trying to get in.
Right. The cast of characters. And the CFTC has very specific legal categories. But really, the biggest thing to master here revolves around what we call the money test.
Yes. The single most critical dividing line between customer-facing firms is whether they are legally allowed to hold customer money.
So let's bring out character number one. Listener, meet Fiona. Fiona is an FCM, a futures commission merchant.
Right. And I want you to picture Fiona in this massive, highly secure skyscraper. She's in a sharp suit, very serious. And right behind her desk is a giant, impenetrable steel vault.
That vault is everything. Fiona, the FCM, solicits and accepts customer orders, but the defining trait is that she actually accepts customer money.
She holds the funds.
She carries the accounts on her own books.
Why does the regulator care so much about that? Like, why the intense scrutiny?
Systemic risk. If you hold billions in customer margin, you are the one dealing with the clearinghouse. If a customer's trade blows up and they can't pay.
But the clearinghouse doesn't care about the customer.
Exactly. They knock on Fiona's door and say, pay up. Because of that risk, FCMs have massive minimum net capital requirements and crazy strict rules about not mixing customer money with the firm's operating cash.
You can't use the vault money to pay your electric bill.
Never.
Okay, so Fiona holds the money. Now let's meet Ivan. Ivan is an IB, an introducing broker.
I love Ivan.
Ivan's not in the skyscraper. He's in a sleek little storefront. He's this fast-talking, charismatic salesperson, shaking hands, taking clients to dinner, bringing in business all day.
But there is one very weird thing about Ivan.
His pockets are literally sewn shut. He doesn't even own a cash register.
Perfect image. Ivan the IB does not accept customer money. Ever. He introduces the account to a carrying FCM.
The money always goes to Fiona.
Always. Let's do an absurd scenario for the listener. You decide to trade futures. You meet Ivan at a coffee shop. You love his strategy. And you find the paperwork. Then you pull a literal shoebox out of your backpack stuffed with $10,000 in cash and you slide it over. Here you go, Ivan. Here's my margin deposit.
Okay, pause and think about it. What happens next?
If Ivan so much as touches that shoebox, he's getting tackled through the coffee shop window by NFA regulators.
SWAT team style.
Yes. An IB cannot take custody. Nope. Ivan legally has to slide it back and say, I can't touch this. Wire it directly to Fiona.
Ivan introduces Fiona Funds. If a test question says an IB custodies assets, it's a lie. It's a trap.
Exactly. The money test is the engine driving so many rules.
Yeah.
Ivan's capital requirements are lower because he doesn't hold the money. Just remember, FCM vault, IB sewn pockets.
Okay, so those are the brokerages. What if a firm actually wants to manage the trading for people? Let's meet Frank. Frank, the founder.
Frank is directing trading, but he has two totally different paths and two different registrations. First path, He becomes a CPO, a commodity pool operator.
So picture Frank standing next to an Olympic swimming pool, but it's not water, it's just filled with cash. He goes around town, gets 10 grand from 50 different investors, throws it all in the pool, and trades futures with that one giant pile of money.
That's a pool. He operates it, he solicits for it. It's like a mutual fund or hedge fund, but for futures. They pool assets for scale and margin efficiency.
Okay, but what if Frank hates the headache of a giant pool? He just wants to sit in his office, look at charts, and tell people what to trade for a subscription fee.
Then Frank is a CTA, a commodity trading advisor. He advises others for compensation on trading futures.
But the money stays in the client's names.
Right, he might manage separate accounts or sell a newsletter, but he's not pooling the money into a single vehicle.
Pool versus advice. CPO pools, CTA advises. All right, but firms are just paperwork. Who are the humans on the phone?
That is the AP, the associated person, the human being who solicits orders or funds for an FCM, IB, CPO, or CTA, or the person supervising them.
Which is basically the salesperson. And honestly, listener, if you're taking the Series 3, this is probably what you are testing to become.
It's almost certain. And it's defined by function. If you solicit, you're an AP. The CFTC doesn't care if your business card says Vice President of Global Strategy.
Senior Executive Ninja, doesn't matter. You solicit, you're an AP. What about the people on the exchange floor?
Two more categories. Floor broker, or FB, and floor trader, or FT. People mix these up constantly.
Oh, I've got a great memory aid for this. Listener, B is for broker and others. T is for trader and self. Let me say it again. B for broker, T for trader.
Right. A floor broker buys or sells for another person. They're an agent. A floor trader buys or sells solely for their own account. They're risking their own money.
Broker for others, trader for self. Okay, that's our roster. Normally, everyone has to register with the CFTC, but there's a really famous exception.
Oh, the GAM loves testing this one.
Frank the CTA and the private activity exemption.
Registration is expensive and slow. Frank might want to avoid it if his CTA business is tiny. The law allows an exemption if he meets a very strict two-part test over the preceding 12 months.
Okay, exceptions are where the traps are. What are the two parts?
Part one, he hasn't furnished advice to more than 15 persons. Part two, he does not hold himself out generally to the public as a CTA.
15 or fewer people, A&D, no public marketing.
It's an A&D test. Both conditions must be met perfectly.
See, that phrasing feels ripe for a loophole. Let's say Frank only advises his mom, his dad, and his dentist. That's three people. Way under 15.
Past part one.
But Frank's proud. So he rents a massive highway billboard that says, Frank's Futures, call me for advice. Does he keep his exemption since he only has three clients?
Exemption blown.
If he
got. Immediately.
Right.
Yes. The moment the billboard goes up, he held himself out to the public. He failed part two. The regulators don't care that his marketing was terrible and only his dentist signed up.
The intent to be public is enough.
Totally enough.
Okay, reverse it. No billboards, no website. Frank runs a totally private, password-protected newsletter, whispers advice in dark corners, completely private. But word spreads, and he's now whispered to 16 people over the last 12 months.
Lone again. He stayed private, but he went over the numerical limit. 15 is the max. He failed part one.
The exam will give you a scenario where one condition is met perfectly. To distract you from the fact that the other was violated, you must stay small, A&D, private.
Exactly. Don't fall for it.
Now, how do they actually enforce all this? Say, Ivan the IB decides to go rogue. He refuses to register, doesn't want to pay NFA dues. How does the industry stop him?
This is the brilliance of the NFA membership requirement. It's the NFA net. Network effects for compliance. The rule is, an NFA member generally cannot carry an account or handle a transaction for a non-member that should be registered.
Okay, let's translate that. Rogue Ivan gets a customer order and tries to send it to Fiona, the FCM, to clear it. Fiona is fully registered and compliant. What does she do?
She rejects it outright. Because Fiona is an NFA member, she is legally forbidden from doing business with Ivan if he's unregistered.
She can't just be like, hey, my hands are clean, I'm just clearing the trade.
No, the net forces Fiona to act as a secondary gatekeeper. If she touches Ivan's rogue trades, she risks her own membership.
It freezes unregistered firms out completely. No compliant firm will touch them.
Self-policing ecosystem at its finest.
All right, we just went through a bunch of highly specific rules, numbers, definitions. I want to do a pattern interrupt right now.
Okay, hit me.
Listener, stop thinking about the textbook. Shake it out. Let's talk about human nature.
Where are we going?
Here is the truth about Wall Street. If you write a rule book with 1,000 hyper-specific rules, some genius with a math degree is going to invent a brand new, highly creative way to be sleazy that isn't technically forbidden yet.
They will always find a loophole.
Right. So if someone invents a new scam on Tuesday, how does the NFA catch them on Wednesday if there's no specific rule against it?
This is exactly why the NFA doesn't just rely on narrow rules. They have a broad catch-all ethics standard. It's called the Just and Equitable Principles of Trade.
It sounds so old school, like a knight's oath. What does it actually mean?
It requires members to observe high standards of commercial honor and deal fairly with customers. It's deliberately open-ended.
It's legally binding, don't be a jerk clause.
Basically, yes.
Yeah.
Think of specific rules like street signs, speed limit 55. If you speed, you broke a specific rule. But this standard is like a general reckless driving law.
Okay, yeah.
If you're driving backward down the highway blindfolded, there might not be a specific sign that says, no driving backward blindfolded, but a cop is still arresting you for reckless driving.
Because you violated the broader expectation of safety.
Yes. You must put the customer's interest first.
Let's use Ivan again. Ivan gets a call from a massive airline. They say, Ivan, buy us 10,000 contracts of crude oil. Ivan knows that massive order is going to act like a bulldozer.
It's going to make the price skyrocket.
Right. So Ivan quickly logs into his personal account, buys 10 contracts for himself, and then enters the airline's order. Price shoots up. Ivan sells his 10 contracts for a risk-free profit.
That's front-running, trading ahead of a customer order. It's a blatant, catastrophic violation of the just and equitable principles.
He put his financial interest ahead of the client's.
Exactly, because his personal buying likely gave the airline a slightly worse execution price.
So for the exam, if they give you a scenario that just feels gross, like clearly dishonest or self-dealing, but it doesn't fit a specific numerical rule.
This broad standard is almost always the answer. If you're in doubt, the rule of thumb is customer first.
Yeah.
Always.
Okay, so we're federally registered. We're in the NFA. We swore not to front-run clients. Now a real, breathing customer walks in. What happens before they can trade?
Opening an account has a rigid checklist. Step one is KYC. Know your customer.
I want to pause here for anyone coming from the securities world. If you have a Series 7, you're used to suitability. If a client wants to do a risky options trade, the broker can literally veto them. No, this is unsuitable for you. Does futures KYC work like that?
No. And this is arguably one of the biggest philosophical traps on the exam. Futures KYC is not a suitability veto.
Let me repeat that. Not a suitability veto. Why is it so different?
It's the nature of the asset class.
Mm-hmm.
Stocks and bonds are for capital formation, building wealth.
Yeah.
Futures are zero-sum risk transfer mechanisms. They're inherently universally high risk.
Right. Everyone knows it's risky.
Exactly. So the NFA says you have to get their financial info, evaluate it, and make sure they get adequate risk disclosure, but you don't have to reject them as unsuitable.
Let's test it. A 90-year-old grandmother walks into Ivan's office. She has her last $5,000 of retirement savings. She says, Ivan, I have a hunch about bacon. I want to trade lean hog futures with maximum leverage.
Oh, boy.
Right. In the Series 7 world, a broker blocks that instantly. Catastrophic suitability violation. In the futures world, what does Ivan do?
His job isn't to be her financial parent. His job is to gather her info, evaluate it, and then give her the risk disclosures. Maybe even highlighted ones because she's inexperienced.
You sure she really gets it?
Yes. But if she is of sound mind and signs the disclosures, Ivan does not have to reject the account. It's a disclosure regime, not a veto regime.
Gather, evaluate, disclose. If a test question says a futures firm must refuse an account on suitability grounds, cross it out. It's a mirage.
Totally. Now, the risk disclosure is the perfect transition to the next step because there are two golden words you have to memorize for the risk disclosure statement.
The two most reliably tested words in the unit, verbatim and before. Let's start with verbatim. Why is that important?
The language of this specific statement is prescribed by the regulator. It has to be delivered essentially word for word, verbatim. You can only make non-substantive changes, like adding a logo.
I'm going to push back because marketing departments hate verbatim regulatory text. It's usually terrifying.
Very terrifying.
What if I have a nervous client and I just want to add a cover letter that says, hey, regulators make us give you this scary document, but our algorithm is so good, you really don't need to worry.
Absolutely not. Verbatim means the substance cannot be diluted or contradicted.
Mm.
If you downplay the risk, you are in violation. You definitely cannot guarantee against losses. The warning has to stand exactly as written.
The regulators want them scared. They want them to respect the leverage. Okay, what about before?
You must receive the signed and dated acknowledgement before opening the account, and strictly before any trading begins.
So I can't let them trade corn all week and then say, oh, hey, can you backdate this signature for me on Friday?
No, it's a pre-trading duty. Without that signature, the account is frozen.
We should probably talk about what that verbatim warning actually says, because the exam tests the substance of it too.
This goes back to your bank analogy from the intro.
Okay, listener, pop quiz. You open a futures account and deposit $5,000 of initial margin. You sign the disclosure. Does that statement assure you that your maximum possible loss is capped at that 5 grand? Give it a beat.
No, it explicitly warns you of the exact opposite.
It tells you, in bold, you can lose more than you deposited.
Yes, because futures require only a small margin deposit to control massive contract value, small market moves are magnified. You can lose the entire deposit and more.
Let's walk through a margin call so they see why. I buy crude oil, market crashes overnight. I'm down 10 grand, but I only have 5 grand in my account. What does the firm do?
They issue a margin call demanding more funds immediately. If you don't wire the money, they have the right to force liquidation. They'll sell your position to stop the bleeding.
But the bleeding didn't stop at zero. I'm negative 5 grand.
And the risk disclosure explicitly warns that you are legally liable for that deficit. You owe them 5 grand. They can come after your other assets.
So if an exam answer implies a customer's downside is limited to their margin deposit, cross it out.
Immediately. So once they sign that terrifying document, you have the standard account opening package.
The three-part harmony.
Yes. One, customer info form proving you did KYC. Two, verbatim risk disclosure, signed. Three, the commodity customer agreement.
The basic legal contract that says they can liquidate you if you default. So the account is open, the customer can call in trades, but what if they want us to do the heavy lifting?
Ah, discretionary accounts. Very heavily tested.
Standard accounts are non-discretionary. I have to ask the client before every single trade. But a discretionary account means handing over the keys. The broker enters trades without asking first.
And because that hands the broker massive trust and massive potential for abuse, the regulators pile on extra rules.
The churning risk is huge. A bad broker could trade 50 times a day just to rack up commission fees. So what's the first requirement?
Written authorization, assigned power of attorney, or POA.
Real-world scenario. My client is a neurosurgeon. He's scrubbing in for a 12-hour surgery. He calls me and says, "The market's going to be crazy today. Just trade my account for me. I trust you completely." That's explicit verbal permission. Can I trade it?
No. Verbal permission is useless for full discretion. You need the signed, written POA on file. If the trade goes bad, he could deny he ever gave you permission.
Written POA is an absolute must. What else?
Active supervision.
Right.
The firm has to maintain records of which accounts are discretionary. And a principal, the boss, has to regularly review them to make sure you aren't just churning for commissions.
Okay. Written POA and active supervision. Can anyone with a Series 3 license take discretion?
No. This is where we meet newbie Ned.
Enter newbie Ned. He passed a Series 3 yesterday, sweating, eager, fresh license in hand. A wealthy client says, "Ned, here's a signed POA. Make me rich." Can Ned start trading?
Ned cannot do it. There's a strict experience bar. Before an AP can exercise full discretion, they must be continuously registered and working in that capacity for at least 2 years.
2 full years. Why so strict?
Because trading someone else's money with a blank check takes an intuitive understanding of liquidity and volatility that you just don't get from a textbook. Discretion is for seasoned pros, not rookies learning on the client's dime.
So, written POA, supervision, and 2 years experience. But is there a gray area? What if the client just wants me to handle the busy work of one specific trade?
Yes, there's a narrow exception called time and price discretion, and it does not require a written POA or the 2 year experience bar.
Okay, listener, analogy time. Let's see if you can spot the difference. Say we're in an office and I tell you, "Hey, I need caffeine. Go buy me a large iced coffee today. I don't care what time you go, and I don't care if it costs $4 or $5. Just get it before the office closes."
Perfect analogy. As the customer, you already made the two biggest strategic decisions. You picked what the asset is, a large iced coffee, and which way it goes. Buying it, not selling it.
Asset and direction.
Right. So in futures, if a customer calls Ivan and says, "Buy 10 contracts of December corn today, get a good price, but definitely buy them before the close," the customer decided the what and the which way.
And because that's so narrowly controlled by the client, the broker doesn't need a written POA to pick the exact minute and price.
Correct. The client retains strategic control. They just outsource the tactical execution. Do not confuse time and price discretion with full discretion.
Classic exam gotcha. If they pick the asset, size, and direction, no POA required. All right, let's zoom out. The accounts are open, trading is happening, some accounts are getting massive.
Which brings us to the grand finale, the ultimate showdown. Position reporting versus speculative limits.
This is the most heavily tested, easily confused part of the unit. People lose their minds trying to keep these separate.
You really have to understand the nightmare regulators are trying to prevent. Market manipulation. If someone holds too much of a commodity, they can corner the market.
Like the Hunt brothers in 1980, they tried to corner silver. They bought so much silver that they drove the price from $6 to almost $50 an ounce in months.
Absolute chaos. Yeah. Jewelers went bankrupt, exchanges panicked, and when it popped, it almost took down Wall Street brokerages.
So regulators need tools to manage giant positions, and they use two different ones, reporting and limits. Let's start with tool number one, position reporting. How does it work?
It's a surveillance tool, a disclosure trigger. The regulator sets a threshold, a certain number of contracts. When a trader crosses it, the carrying firm, Fiona, has to file daily reports to the CFTC detailing what that trader is doing.
So it's a tripwire, like, hey, look over here.
Exactly. Like anti-money laundering laws. You deposit 10 grand cash at a bank, the bank files a report, they don't arrest you, they don't stop you, they just tell the government.
Position reporting equals tell them, but who gets reported?
Everyone. It's objectively size-based. It doesn't matter why you're trading, degenerate gambler or fifth-generation farmer. You cross the line, you get reported.
And what's the consequence? Do I have to sell?
No. That's the trap. You report it, and you keep the position. It's mandatory disclosure, not a cap.
Got it. Now, tool number two, speculative position limits.
If reporting is radar, limits are a brick wall. This is a hard, absolute ceiling on the maximum net long or net short position a person can hold.
You can't hold more. Who does this catch?
Look in the name. Speculators only. It protects the market from unbacked speculation like the Hunt brothers.
And if I exceed it, if I buy one contract over the limit.
Sheer strict liability violation. You must stop adding immediately. You'll be forced to liquidate down to the limit and you'll face fines.
So reporting is binoculars, limits are handcuffs. But wait, what about the commercial businesses, the airlines, the cereal companies?
This is the exemption. Bona fide hedgers people offsetting genuine fiscal cash market risk can apply for a hedge exemption. If approved, they can go above the speculative limit, up to the level of their actual physical risk.
Okay, let's bring in two new characters for the ultimate showdown. Meet Reckless Ricky. Pure speculator in Miami, treats futures like a casino, buying wheat just because a chart told him to.
And our second character is Hedging Helen, pragmatic agricultural CEO. She owns massive wheat farms. She's selling wheat futures to lock in a sale price for her actual physical harvest. Genuine commercial risk.
Ricky gambles with paper. Helen protects a physical business. Listener, direct question time. Both Ricky and Helen keep adding to their positions. Eventually, both cross the position reporting level. Do they both get reported? Give it a beat.
Yes, they both get reported.
Both of them.
Reporting is a tripwire based on size. The raider doesn't care about motives. Everyone gets reported.
Okay, they keep trading. They get bigger. Now, Ricky hits the speculative position limit. What happens?
Ricky hits the brick wall. Violation. He's a pure speculator. No physical backing. He cannot buy one more contract.
Handcuffs for Ricky. What about Helen? She hits the exact same limit. What happens?
Helen does not hit the wall. She applies for a hedge exemption. Because she has real physical wheat risk, they grant her relief. She can exceed the limit up to her commercial exposure.
Helen gets a pass. Ricky hits a wall. This is the ultimate exam trap. Never swap them.
Exactly. If a question asks what happens when a pure speculator crosses the reportable level, the answer is not a violation. They just get reported. If it asks if a commercial hedger is subject to reporting, the answer is yes.
So here's the visual for the testing center. Position reporting is binoculars. Regulators just watching. Speculative limits are a brick wall. Binoculars for everyone, brick walls for speculators only.
That's the perfect way to anchor it.
Man, we have covered a massive amount of ground today. We opened the firms, onboarded the clients, policed the giant trades. Time for the rapid fire recap. Six absolute must-know takeaways. If you zoomed out, zoom back in. Here we go.
Number one, two gatekeepers. CFTC grants federal registration. NFA grants membership and enforces daily rules. You need both to touch the public.
Number two, the money test. Fiona the FCM holds the money. Ivan the IB does not.
Number three, the CTA exemption. Frank needs both conditions. 15 or fewer people and D0 public marketing.
Number four, risk disclosure, verbatim. signed before trading, and it explicitly warns you can lose more than your deposit.
Number 5. Discretionary accounts. Full discretion means a written POA and supervision. Newbie Ned needs 2 full years' experience. Only exception is time and price discretion, where the customer picks the asset and direction.
And number 6, the showdown. Position reporting catches everybody. Speculative limits catch speculators, but bona fide hedgers like Helen get an exemption. Binoculars versus brick walls.
That is the core architecture of Chapter 8. Understand that, and you'll crush that 29%.
To close this out, I want to leave the listener with a final provocative thought, something to mull over.
What is it?
Think about the logic behind hedging Helen. Why do regulators gladly give her a pass on limits, but absolutely refuse to give her a pass on reporting? She grows the food we eat. Why spy on her? Why make her file daily paperwork?
It's a fascinating paradox. It really gets to the heart of what the CFTC cares about.
It shows their true philosophy. They aren't trying to punish legitimate businesses. The market was invented for Helen. But they demand absolute, uncompromised visibility. Even a well-intentioned player could accidentally distort the global price if they get too big.
Information is their only currency. They tolerate massive size, but they cannot tolerate a blind spot. Blind spots are how clearinghouses fail.
Exactly. Huh. Build your skyscraper as high as you want if you have a commercial foundation, but you still have to show the city inspector every blueprint every single day.
And if you don't,
the NFA bouncer kicks you out, the CFTC revokes your license, and Ivan won't even buy you coffee.
It's an unforgiving system, but you hold the keys now.
You absolutely do. Good luck mastering Chapter 8, and good luck conquering the Series 3. You've got this. We'll see you on the next deep dive.